From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's a new year, and as glad tidings fade, what's left are hangovers, especially for sloppy journalists. Craig Silverman is the creator of RegretTheError.com, and he joins us once again with his annual list of media mistakes. The known blunders have finally reached critical mass because, he says, in 2009, the big thing was
calling BS, also known as fact-checking. Oftentimes when there are layoffs at a magazine, the fact checkers are usually the first people to go because they look at their staff and they say, well, you sort of check other people's work. You don't actually produce reporting. But what's going on is that fact checking is becoming kind of a sport now. And everybody from pundits to people in the public are all engaging in fact checking and trying to call BS on each other. And there were just a lot of examples of it this year. A website, PolitiFact, they're a fact checking organization, won a Pulitzer. And then, of course, there's The Daily Show, which has really taken up a lot of fact checking. We've talked about the disappearance of the professional fact checker. Well, The Daily Show actually has one on staff, so they seem to be picking up the slack.
Okay, let's get down to business. What was the error of the year?
The error is called Wafergate because back in July, a Canadian newspaper, The Telegraph Journal, reported that the Prime Minister of Canada, when he was taking communion at a church, that he had taken the wafer, which represents the body of Christ, and placed it in his pocket. And the newspaper ran a front page story. They had quotes from a very senior priest in the area saying that this was an outrage, and basically it turned into a national scandal. It didn't have any evidence that he had placed it in his pocket. The accusations were inserted at some point in the editorial process after the reporters had actually filed the story. And in fact, those quotes from the priest saying this was a scandal were pretty much fabricated, or at the very least, sexed up a little bit. So they had to make a couple of very big groveling apologies. The editor of the paper lost her job, but we still don't actually know who inserted this accusation in the paper. Unfortunately, this sort of lack of disclosure is all too common.
Okay, then let's go to the correction of the year. This one comes from the Washington Post.
So here's the correction from the Washington Post. A November 26 article incorrectly said a Public Enemy song declared 9/11 a joke. The song refers to 911, the emergency phone number. What's interesting is the correction of the year is again an example of an editor causing the mistake. Now, the writer of the article was actually very upset with what happened because the correction went around Twitter and went around online. A lot of people were ridiculing her, saying that she didn't know anything about hip hop. And as it turned out, that it actually wasn't her fault. A copy editor had made the change.
And weirdly, the Washington Post's policy is they don't say who made the error. They're quite opaque on this point.
They do have a policy that states, as a collective organization, we share the collective blame for our errors. And so, you know, the reporter who is sort of getting mocked for this wrote an article that she tried to have placed in the paper about what it felt like to have been made fun of for an error that wasn't her fault. And the paper rejected that, too.
This year's apology of the year is really serious.
It's from The Sun, a tabloid in England. And it is a pretty serious apology for some pretty serious accusations. So here's the apology of the year from The Sun. In a report on May 5th, we claimed that Arthur Boritz had brought two girls to the house he shares with partner Sarah Monet and had sex with one of them. We published a picture which we said showed him straightening one of the girls' hair. We now accept the picture was in fact of Boritz and his younger sister Paulina in Poland some years earlier, and that neither did Mr. Boritz invite back nor have sex with either of the girls in our story. We apologize to Mr. Boritz and Ms. Monet for any embarrassment caused.
When writing the corrections, some newspapers take care to repeat every inaccuracy in their correction. But isn't there an argument for not repeating every ill-informed detail so they aren't fixed in the readers' minds?
This is one of the great debates of corrections, and it's to repeat or not to repeat the error. And there are some that are very, very stringent that we absolutely must restate what was incorrect and then provide the correct information so that anyone who had read the story can remember, oh, right, I read that. Okay, here's the correct information. An example of a publication that does that as a rule is the New York Times. Then you have the other school of thought, which is that, well, if we restate the error, we're just compounding the damage. In some cases, repeating accusations about somebody having sex with girls, a lot of people would read that and say, you know what, it's kind of like they're sticking the knife in again.
Obviously, we've only gone through a few of them, and that's all we have time for. But I don't want to take away your opportunity to give us your personal favorite.
It's from the Los Angeles Times, and here's the correction. An item in the National Briefing in Sunday's Section A said a bear wandered into a grocery store in Hayward, Wisconsin on Friday and headed for the beer cooler. It was Thursday.
But the rest of it's okay.
That's it. You know, he was looking for a beer. What's your problem?
Well, I guess that's a perfect way to end the year. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is the creator of RegretTheError.com. One way news organizations discover their mistakes is when attentive readers email in corrections. And for a number of reporters in D.C., a disproportionate number of those emails seem to come from one Daniel Lipman. A recent Politico profile dubs him the Washington Press Corps' independent fact-checker, copy editor, and link distributor extraordinaire, and suggests that any D.C. reporter worth anything has at some point heard from the friendly, humble, accurate Mr. Lipman, sometimes just moments after the article goes live, sometimes daily. So, who is he? That's what Ron Fournier, the Associated Press's Washington bureau chief, wanted to know. After all, nearly three-quarters of the articles he writes provoke a Lipman missive. So he wrote back with some questions of his own, discovered Lipman was a 19-year-old kid, and invited him to come by the AP's D.C. bureau. First, let's talk to Ron Fournier. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So how did Daniel Lipman pop up on your radar?
Well, he popped up not on my radar, but in my email, like he does on dozens of other reporters and editors' email. For several years now, he's been sending me notes when I'd write a story, pointing out three or four things I had wrong with it, either typos or matters of grammar, or in some cases, matters of fact.
Could you tell who this guy was, how old he was?
Had no idea. I presumed he was a gray-bearded law professor wearing a tweed jacket and elbow patches, and I found out that he lived just a few miles away from where I'm sitting right now and attended George Washington University.
And so you invited him to take a tour of the AP's Washington Bureau. Politico described it as a visit from royalty, or at least that's how he was treated by the AP newsroom.
It was. I don't know if I could have turned as many heads if I'd brought the President of the United States in. As soon as I walked out and said, hey, does anybody here know Daniel Lipman? A bunch of heads popped up, phones were hung up, and people jumped up from their desk. And before I knew it, there was, I don't know, 8-10 reporters gathered around him, talking him up. And you know, as a journalist, sometimes you forget who you're writing for. And here in the flesh and the blood was a young man who we've been writing for several years and has actually been a part of what we do.
So what's his writing style? What's the substance?
Well, it's very polite. It always starts in the fine article or in the wonderful article. So he starts with a flattery. It's not partisan or, you know, hardly charged or, you know, like some of the emails we get. They're always just very point by point, almost as if you were correcting a school paper in a way that you didn't want to insult the student.
Is his batting average near perfect?
They're almost always spot on. Then you start looking for his name. For the last year or two, whenever I see Lipman pop up on my queue, I'd be drawn right towards it.
You know, there's a lot of talk about citizen journalism, and I think it brings to mind the image of thousands of citizens knocking on thousands of doors.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Daniel's is a more efficient manifestation of that idea?
I don't know if it's more efficient necessarily. It's just one of the forms. In many ways, we're becoming a lot more closely connected with our audience. For the last 20 years, supposedly I was writing for Daniel Lipman. What's wrong with me now actually engaging with Daniel Lipman?
You haven't been writing for Daniel for 20 years because he's only 19.
Good point. Good.
This wouldn't have been possible before the internet.
It would not have. What would a guy like Daniel Lipman have done before? Sent a letter in the snail mail and it would have arrived 4 or 5 days later and we probably wouldn't have done anything with it. Now I can make the correction literally within 5 minutes after him sending the email.
Ron Fournier is the Associated Press's Washington bureau chief. Once we heard about Lipman, we knew we had to look out for him. And sure enough, in an online video we happened to catch with the New York Times' Andrew Revkin, a question came in from a Daniel Lipman. The kid's everywhere. So we tracked him down. He says his hobby got a boost a few summers ago when he got a job copy editing for a newspaper called the Berkshire Eagle. But he was doing this for years before that.
Since I read a lot of articles, if I saw a fact that was not a fact or an error, I sometimes would write to the reporter and pointing it out. And every day I'll send 10 emails or so.
So when you say you read a lot of articles, that's kind of a massive understatement. You read like 80 articles a day. I mean, does that rewire your brain?
Those 80 articles aren't always the length of a New Yorker 10-page piece. So they're sometimes pretty short. What I usually do is I get my schoolwork done, and then I look for interesting articles in the papers I read and the blogs and stuff like that. I only read articles that I'm interested in.
There was an interview that I think CNN did with you when you were 15 years old. At that point, you were already a participant in White House online chats.
Daniel Lipman looks like an average 15-year-old. He also spends his free time chatting online with some of the most important people in the world. Top officials at the White House.
I just wonder where somebody like you comes from.
I think my parents always encouraged my sisters and I, or me, to be informed citizens and not just apathetic. Whenever I read stories about Afghanistan and when I read stories about bombings in there or Pakistan, it makes me feel lucky to live in a country where I don't have to worry that I'm going to get attacked. So it just makes me appreciate how vibrant our democracy is, even though there are imperfections. You can't make something perfect.
I'm wondering, Daniel, do you have a larger goal here? By being the great seeing eye on journalism that you are you trying to make the entire trade less vulnerable to attacks that the media are biased or liars or lazy or venal or stupid or craven?
I think when people say the media is bias, I think that's a pretty weak argument. But when you have more accurate articles, I think it makes it more legitimate so people can't take cheap pot shots at the media.
Do you know what you want to do after you graduate? Surprise me. Tell me that it's big game hunting.
I'm not a hunter. But I'd probably like to work in media some way or in public policy, maybe in a think tank or in government.
Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Daniel Lipman is a sophomore at George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Just had a few questions for you.
Just don't appreciate.
Why are you trying to ruin Christmas for the children?
Just please.
Angelo, you're banning candy canes from the holiday sale.
How are you?
Don't you think that's crazy?
That's producer Jesse Waters from Fox News' O'Reilly Factor, launching into an ambush interview of a school superintendent in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Ambush interviews are an O'Reilly specialty. That's when a show producer, camera crew in tow, stalks and then corners a subject who has declined to come on the show. Although some victims say they were never asked to begin with. In the clip you just heard, the target was a superintendent who had refused to allow religious decorations to be displayed in an elementary school's holiday gift room. Earlier this year, before frightened Chelmsford school officials were captured on national TV, some media watchers had already noted one similarity among O'Reilly's targets. They were all pretty obscure. Writing in the New York Times, reporter Brian Stelter named a few of the relatively small fish caught in O'Reilly's net. There was Mike Hoyt, editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, circulation 20,000. There was Hendrik Hertzberg, a New Yorker staff writer who's not quite a household name. And then there was the ambush of a relatively unknown blogger named Amanda Turkle.
Did you actually ever hear the Radio Factor segment in question?
Yes.
So what was the Mel Gibson component to Bill's analysis?
I don't believe I highlighted the Mel Gibson component.
Do you know what the Mel Gibson component was?
No.
Why not?
Because I didn't highlight it.
Because you didn't hear it, did you? Because you're just dishonest.
Of course, while the O'Reilly Factor can lay claim to the title of Ambush Central, it certainly did not invent that technique. For that honor, most people credit or blame CBS's 60 Minutes, and specifically, Mike Wallace.
Well, come on out. No, just you don't want to talk to me?
Why are you so reluctant? Why are you so reluctant?
We've got to get over here, Mike. We want to just get right over here.
I don't understand. They must be ashamed of something.
This past summer, we spoke to John Cook, investigations editor for the media gossip site Gawker, who said that there is a significant difference between today's ambushes and the ambushes of yore.
The classic ambush style, usually there was some kind of public issue at stake. For instance, when Mike Wallace was going after someone who's renting an apartment and they're discriminating against African-Americans, there's something of consequence at stake. And many of the ambushes that Jesse Waters has done for Bill O'Reilly are really about sort of carrying out Bill O'Reilly's personal vendettas against people who wrote things about him that he didn't like. And also, when 60 Minutes does it, they actually try to get the person under civilized circumstances to speak to them. They actually try to interview them. Hendrik Hertzberg of The New Yorker and Amanda Turkle of Think Progress say they never had any idea that Bill O'Reilly wanted to talk to them.
So let's hear what that sounds like.
So after he refused to come on The Factor, we sent Jesse Waters out to see him.
Are you going to apologize to Mr. Gingrich?
No. Are you going to apologize to me?
For what?
for invading my pleasant morning.
So what's gained by this kind of confrontation if you're Fox News Channel?
Well, the theater is great, especially for Fox's audience to have some egghead liberal caught unawares and looking freaked out and frightened and confronted with the righteous ideas of Bill O'Reilly through his messenger, Jesse Waters. So it makes for great television. And it made for great television when Mike Wallace was doing it and when other people do it as well. And that's one of the reasons anybody does these things.
Now, this technique can only work, and the theater only works properly if the ambusher has the presumed moral authority in the confrontation, as Mike Wallace did. By the time he shows up, you've already seen how bad the bad guy is who's been avoiding him. When Jesse Waters bothers Amanda Turkle on vacation or whatever, does he have that kind of audience sympathy, even Bill O'Reilly's audience?
I think he does, or they wouldn't do it. I think, by and large, with Bill O'Reilly's audience, there's a deliberate attempt to create heroes and villains, or whatever, patriots and pinheads, as Bill O'Reilly puts it. I know in Amanda Turkle's case, and if memory serves, in Hendrik Hertzberg's case as well, it wasn't the first time that they had been mentioned on the show. They mention them over a period of days, and then there's this confrontation. And I think that's sort of getting the audience used to the idea of these people as enemies of Bill O'Reilly, as liars, as people who are spreading mistruths about him, and he's going to go out there and set things straight.
All right, so you decided to give Jesse Waters a taste of his own medicine. How did you go about doing that?
Well, it started because after the Amanda Turkle ambush, that got a lot of publicity and there was a lot of interest in this, and the New York Times did a story on Jesse Waters and Bill O'Reilly's ambush interviews. And there was something in there that leapt out at me, which was Jesse Waters declined repeated requests for an interview for this story, which I found obviously odd, given that part of his job is to force other people to answer questions for Bill O'Reilly, irrespective of their desires.
Well, you didn't find it odd. You found it hypocritical and predictable and just absolutely delicious.
Well, no, but I would say actually that I would think that if Jesse Waters sort of had his head screwed on straight, he would realize that the smartest thing he could do is just openly answer questions about it and try to inoculate the issue, whether it's to the New York Times or to us. But you're right, it presented an opportunity. So we decided we had some questions for Jesse Waters. So we drove out to his house at 6 o'clock in the morning with a video camera and waited for him to leave. And I consider it ungentlemanly to sneak up on someone the way he does. So we came up with an idea where we would be out there. And at 7 o'clock in the morning, we posted to Gawker a photograph of me outside Jesse's house saying, "We're here. We'd like to talk to you." And we have a pretty reasonable assurance that someone within Fox would see that, because I know the Fox publicity people read Gawker fairly religiously, and they've emailed me within seconds of things that I've posted going up. So we had a pretty good idea that he would be aware. So we waited for him, and he dodged us that morning because we're pretty much amateurs, and we didn't anticipate the urgent need for a bathroom break. I'm sure that's something that Jesse figured out long ago in his career of ambushes, but we're newbies.
Two words for future reference, tag team, okay?
right.
Okay, so the gag is pretty funny, but I'm just curious, how far into Jesse Waters' personal life are you willing to intrude to pay off this joke?
One of the ambushes that Jesse did was a guy named Bill Arkin, who's a columnist for the Washington Post's website and also an analyst for NBC News. And he had written something that Bill O'Reilly didn't like. And Jesse wound up tailing him for about an hour and a half across state lines. And when he found Bill Arkin and approached him, he was on some kind of family outing with young children. And Jesse walked right up to him and stuck a microphone in his face. That was pretty objectionable to me. It's clear from Jesse's MO that that's deliberate. They don't get them when they're coming out of the car at their house because they can go back in. They wait for them to get in the car and then drive somewhere. And they get them in a public space where they're unable to escape.
And most flummoxed?
Yeah, especially if you're not someone who's accustomed to that kind of attention. And that's why they do it that way. So I'm not going to go on his property, but if and when we get him, we have to do it in a public place where he's out with his wife or something having dinner, you know, if that's what it takes, I don't see any real barriers for me to doing that.
That's John Cook of Gawker. He decided to have another go at ambushing Jesse Waters, so we sent OTM producer PJ Vogt to go along for the ride. Okay, PJ, what happened?
Well, we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we drove from Brooklyn. It was me, John Cook, and Gawker's video guy, Richard Blakely. I actually recorded it, so I can let John set the scene.
We're in Huntington, New York, and we're parked outside Jesse Waters' house. It's 7:17 a.m. on a Saturday, and Jesse's car is here, and his garage door is open, which is a very encouraging sign.
When we first got there, we were really excited because the garage door was open. So we immediately had this theory that Jesse and his wife, Noelle, that they left it open because they were packing the car or something and they were going to come out any minute. And we sat there for almost 3 more hours. We were in this big black SUV with tinted windows, which John had rented because he thought it was less conspicuous than his regular car. About 9:45, the garage door started to roll down. And a couple seconds after that, you can hear Richard, the video guy, and he's really worried that she's going to see us. And John's whispering and trying to convince him that we're safe because there's these tinted windows on our SUV. Oh,
it's Noelle. It's Noelle. Window. Don't worry. It's tinted. She won't be able to see in.
She's coming by. She's coming by. Oh, my God. She's going to walk right by.
Okay. So you're staking out somebody's house in this gigantic SUV with the tinted windows. How are you feeling at this point?
Unbelievably excited. The thing I learned about ambush interviews working on this piece is whether or not they're good journalism, they're extremely, extremely fun. And then like a minute after that, after Noelle had come out, the garage door rolls back up and Jesse Waters himself comes out and then all hell broke loose. In this next piece of tape, if you listen, you can hear John say, "Oh, bleep, sorry." That was us getting tangled up in each other as we sort of fell out of the car and him slamming the car door on me.
It's Jesse.
Oh, my God.
Let's go.
Wait, all right, wait, let me get my...
Go.
I'm ready.
Oh, sorry. John Cook from Gawker, how are you? Mind if we ask you some questions?
How you doing?
Not bad, how about yourself?
Not bad.
Do you like stalking people? Hi, Noelle. Do you mind if we ask you some questions? Why won't you answer our questions? Are you scared to answer questions? Can we use your bathroom?
There ends my stalking adventure.
Okay, so you guys are kind of the gang that couldn't shoot straight after sitting there for 5 hours. You can't get out of the car, and he gets away.
Yeah, well, John considered it a success because he felt like he made his point. I think the first thing that it's worth noting is that he broke or at least bent two of the ground rules that he laid down in his interview with you. We didn't post a picture on Gawker sort of warning that we were outside. And when we did ambush him, we ended up cutting across his property, which John had said he was reluctant to do. Also, by the time we got there, Jesse was just totally laughing at us. He saw us fall out of the car. So I'm not sure the operation totally succeeded.
I got to ask you this, PJ. You're doing this story because the presumption is that the Fox News Channel style of ambush is gratuitous and sleazy. And yet you've confessed that you were very excited about the whole thing. How do you square this circle?
Oh, I don't know. When we were on our way up there, I kept trying to interview John and I kept asking him some variation on the question. Did he worry that he was like the rogue cop who had broken so many rules chasing the criminal that he'd become the criminal? And he didn't feel like he had, but honestly, I think we tiptoed over to the dark side.
All right, PJ. Well, welcome back to the side of good.
Thanks, Bob.
PJ Vogt is a producer for On the Media.
If the ambush has fallen into disrepute, it had an honorable start, relatively speaking. Lowell Bergman is an award-winning journalist and educator who, for nearly 15 years, was a producer for CBS's 60 Minutes. During his long tenure there, he watched as Mike Wallace pioneered, refined, and then more or less abandoned the ambush interview. He says that showing up on the doorstep of reticent sources was a time-honored print reporter tactic, but nobody knew if it would work in the age of television.
The big question in the news business was, could you do that with a camera? What Mike started doing was confronting those people on the street, and that can be pretty dramatic. It's what Don Hewitt used to call that delicious moment. Mike came out of a closet in a number of cases and surprised somebody in an undercover operation. One of those cases, the Colonel Herbert case, led to a major First Amendment decision in the appellate court in New York.
Can you tell us about that case briefly?
There were allegations about his conduct in the Vietnam War. He sued. The case went up to the appellate federal court in New York and came back with it being thrown out and providing more privileges for us for operating in terms of and for fear of libel litigation. That became part of the signature moment of 60 Minutes, including the moment where Mike and now, let's say more recently, Steve Croft comes up on someone like a used car dealer after they've been surreptitiously taped talking about how they're going to cheat their customers, and then they confront them. All of that has really become a lot more entertainment and noise than really enlightening.
But you think in the old days it actually yielded more news and less heat?
There's nothing that says that news shouldn't be entertaining and get people's interest. But as Mike himself has said in the past, he stopped doing it really by the early 1980s because it had become a cliche. Everyone was imitating it. You had Geraldo chasing people down the streets. What's clear in the more recent controversies is that we're not really talking about news.
So let's talk about how it is used nowadays. Obviously, Bill O'Reilly, also Michael Moore. In some cases, this is commentary. In some cases, this is entertainment.
Yeah, in some cases, it's just simply titillation. You know, all of this began with programs in the old days called Candid Camera, showing people when they're off guard, when they're weak, when they're not expecting someone not only to come up to them and ask them a question, but recording it at the same time.
Do you think Mike Wallace may have taken some of his inspiration from Candid Camera?
Oh, I know he did. I've talked to him about it. Mike and some of the producers used it as a way to really dramatize what would often be either A, a boring story, or B, a story you couldn't get on film without actually confronting someone. In the tobacco stories that I was doing with CBS, we were trying to interview the media consultant for Brown & Williamson Tobacco. He gave me some expletives and said, you know, there was no way that was going to happen. I called him back and I said, look, we also need your picture. We don't really have a picture of you. And I said, why don't you dress up the way you want to dress up and look on camera and walk down the street for us as opposed to us having to ambush you, right? He again blew me off. So we stationed a camera crew right outside his building in Manhattan. And it really was just to get a shot of him. He was startled by seeing that, and he walked right up to the camera and started talking to it. Made a great sequence in the piece.
Did 60 Minutes distinguish, and does it now distinguish, between true public figures and those who actually might be vulnerable?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've got assets. They've got to worry about litigation, and privacy and other litigation can be very tough. An example is the primary Supreme Court case, as I recall, related to taking a camera crew into a restaurant to find somebody. The Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, CBS violated the privacy of everyone in the restaurant by just simply going in when the owner said leave. So the result is you won't see camera crews rushing into where people have an expectation of privacy. So there are rules of the road out there that normal news organizations will follow.
When Bill O'Reilly cites Mike Wallace as an influence, as he has, does he have a point?
Well, sure. Mike, to a certain extent, had a great flair for entertainment. He was a drama major in college, and he was the announcer for the Green Hornet and other radio shows. So the line between entertainment and, quote, news in broadcasting wasn't as developed until much later when he got involved in television. There's a real difference, though. Bill O'Reilly is not a news person. He's a journalist. He's an advocate. He's a personality. He's very wealthy and successful, and good for him. But I don't think he can cite news standards for what he does. He's not interested in the other side of the story, and he makes that very clear in the way he conducts himself. And I don't think you could say the same of Mike Wallace.
Lowell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lowell Bergman is a producer and correspondent for PBS's Frontline. He's also a professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and was a producer for 60 Minutes between 1983 and 1997.
When it's least expected, you're elected, you're the star today. Smile, you're on Candid Camera.
Coming up, the timeless art of the pitch.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Smile, you're on Candid Camera.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Smile, you're alive.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 2008, total U.S. ad spending across all media fell more than 2.5%, as many companies, feeling the pinch of the recession, slashed their budgets. That turned out to be good news, however, for the infomercial industry, which took advantage of cheaper airtime to hawk its wares. In 2008, advertising for so-called direct response products was already up nearly 10% for everything from the Snuggie to the ShamWow.
It's like a chamois, it's like a towel, it's like a sponge. This is for the house, the car, the boat, the RV. ShamWow.
Perhaps the most recognizable pitchman of the entire decade was Billy Mays, who died this summer at the age of 50. Mays may have gained fame and fortune through television, but as we learned in a piece we first ran earlier this year, On the Media producer Mike Volo remembers when Mays was pitching not to 20 million people, but rather 20.
Growing up in northern New Jersey in the 1970s and 80s, I would make regular trips down to Atlantic City with my family when school was out. There are certain sounds that stick out in my memory from those summers on the boardwalk. The ocean, of course. Seagulls screeching overhead just outside the Planters Peanut store. The arcade. Oh, yeah. And this guy.
There's no pumps, there's no motors, there's no batteries. It works direct from a bucket. Wash your car, your boat, your camper, your trailer.
That's Billy Mays pitching the amazing Washmatic, a portable cleaning system. If you weren't a professional pitchman, you might call it a 10-foot hose, a simple siphon with a one-way valve. It helps you save water.
One bucket to wash, one bucket to rinse.
Mays would set up on the boardwalk with a Washmatic and a minivan door and pitch that product all day. It earned him the nickname Bucket Billy. May says he learned from some of the best pitchmen we'll never know, guys selling everything from fishing gear to facial cream, and he counts himself among the last of the old mold. He even uses the jargon of the hard sell during conversation. You don't gather a crowd, you bally one. And it's not a crowd, it's a tip. Like a lot of pitchmen, Mays gets something close to reverential when he talks about what those in the industry call the turn.
All this so important turn. When you have that perfect pitch going, you better ask for the money. You better turn them right there because they're ready. They're ready to pull out the $20 right then and there. They already got it waving in the air. Sometimes that turn didn't always happen so quick. You had to go clap and bring them out of it. You're number one. You're number two. One thing you didn't want to happen, the front of your tip, break up and leave. You know, if you leave now, I'll never talk to you. Don't you dare do that right now. You kind of just force them to stay.
Mays pitched the Washmatic on the boardwalk, on the pier, and at state fairs for more than 10 years. It was in 1993 at the Pittsburgh Home and Garden Show that he met Max Apple, an amateur inventor who developed a citrus cleaner in his garage in Colorado. A few years later, Apple hired Maze to pitch the product, Orange Glow Wood Cleaner and Polish, on TV.
Made with pure orange oil. It cleans, polishes, and protects all of the
Maze sold 6,000 bottles the first day, and then Apple expanded his business, with Maze again as the pitch man, to include something he called OxyClean.
It's powered by the air you breathe, activated by the water that you and I drink. In your laundry, the power of bleach, but it's safe. Watch this.
And ever since, late at night, early in the morning, whenever TV channels have cheap airtime to sell, Billy Maze has been coming into our homes.
Hi, Billy Maze here for Mighty Putty. Hi, Billy Maze here for the Big City Slider Station.
Hi, Billy Maze here for the Steam Buddy.
Hi, Billy Maze here for the Jupiter Jack.
Hi, Billy Maze back again with the Awesome Auger.
Hi, Billy Maze here for the Toll Bandit.
Hi, Billy Maze here for the world's greatest insole, Impact Gel. Why am I smashing my hand with this hammer? To show you the amazing protection you get from Impact Gel.
That last product, Impact Gel, in case you couldn't hear him, is featured in the first episode of Maze's new reality show on the Discovery Channel called Pitchmen. Billy Maze.
You know, if you ask me what I am right now, I am a pitchman. I only know how to do one thing, sell products. It was taboo at certain times during my career where we would call ourselves professional demonstrators. Now, I'm proud to say I, Billy Maze, am a pitchman. That's what I am.
I think it's a term that historically rises and falls.
Glenn Hinson is a folklorist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He says that during the old medicine shows of the late 19th century, a pitchman would prefer to call himself a talker and to call his pitch a lecture.
The idea of the lecture was to somehow wrap the rhetoric of the remarkable in the framing of the familiar. You wanted to invite your audience, the tip, to think differently about what they needed in their lives so that the audience would reach into their pockets, pull out that dollar bill for that bottle of tonic, and make the purchase.
I'm going to paint a word picture that the smallest boy or girl in the audience can understand. Those of you that keep house, you have sitting at your back door what we call a slop bucket or a garbage can.
One medicine show doctor, Dr. Fred Bloodgood, he used to say that the credo of many of the med show talkers was never use one word when four would suffice.
I've been putting that same food into my stomach, not for a day, not for a week, a month, or a year, but for 5 years, for 10 years, and I've never cleaned it up.
The first nail in the coffin of the old med shows was the Federal Food and Drugs Act of 1906. Its stated purpose was to prevent, quote, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of adulterated or misbranded or poisonous or deleterious foods, drugs, medicines, and liquors.
Something that would pass a tapeworm, head and all.
That put the medicine show on notice, and it eventually died out. Glenn Hinson.
In the history of medicine shows, if you look at those performers who went on from there, performers would move into vaudeville. They would move more particularly into places like the Grand Ole Opry. And in the Grand Ole Opry, where you have this idea of a radio show that combined pitches with entertainment, with the advent of television, it was a very simple move to make.
In the late 1940s, a guy named Nat Morris was hiring people, mostly his own family, to pitch products on the boardwalks of New Jersey. Nat Morris was the head of an extended family dynasty of pitchmen. In-laws, cousins, nephews. His own son, Arnold, was something of a pitching prodigy. You know that gimmick where some guy cuts through metal to demonstrate just how sharp the knife is? Arnold invented that 60 years ago.
This could be a chicken bone. It could be a ham bone, frozen food. This is steel against steel. Take a look at this. Something has to give. You see those filings over here? Now, there's only one way to find out if that knife is still razor sharp. You go back to the same tomato today, tonight. Tomorrow, next week, next year, for the rest of your life, you never, ever have to sharpen a knife.
Between the years 1948 and 1954, the number of American households owning TV sets shot from less than 1% to more than 55%. It was during that time that the Morrises took the pitches they perfected on the boardwalks and filmed them as commercials. Modern-day medicine show talkers beamed right into our homes. They even shot half-hour spots, what we would now call infomercials, for the old Dumont network. They were disguised as cooking shows, but the whole point was to sell a Morris family product called the Roto-Broil, a rotisserie.
Hi, this is Lester Morris, the Roto-Magician, and here's our menu for today. Smorgasbord, Swedish meatballs, Sill salad, and Scandifus casserole.
Remember I said extended family dynasty? The Morrises were related to the Popeils, who struck gold in the 1960s with a whole line of kitchen gadgets, the Veg-O-Matic, Dial-O-Matic, even a Whip-O-Matic, pushing the infomercial pitch so deep into our pop cultural psyche that Dan Aykroyd spoofed it on Saturday Night Live in 1976.
How many times has this happened to you? You have a bass. You're trying to find an exciting new way to prepare it for dinner. You could scale the bass, remove the bass's tail, head and bones, and serve the fish as you would any other fish dinner. But why bother now that you can use Robco's amazing new kitchen tool, the Super Bass-O-Matic 76?
Yes, if anyone could sell Aykroyd's Bass-O-Matic,
the tool that lets you use the whole bass.
Surely it would be Ron Popeil. Of the entire clan of Morrises and Popeils, some of the best salesmen America has ever seen, it is Ron who has been the most successful. It is Ron who has elevated the infomercial to its grand synthesis of theater and commerce. It is Ron who best put to practice the old pitchman's axiom. It's not what you sell, it's how you tell them the price.
You know you're not going to spend $400 for it, not $375 or $350. Not $325 or even $300. Not $275 or $250. Not $225 or even $200 like you all may be thinking. Not $190 or even $180. All you spend for this fabulous machine, an over $400 value, all you spend is just four easy monthly payments of $39.95.
They never tell you what the full price is because psychologists have done research on this and found that breaking things into smaller payments fools the human mind into thinking that it's really not the same thing.
Remy Stern is the author of But Wait, There's More, a book about the infomercial industry. He says another pitchman's ploy is to push the idea that time is running out, which he could do pretty convincingly on the boardwalk.
Usually he has more, probably in his truck about a block away. But the boxes that you'll see standing right next to him, there'll be a limited number, and he'll use that to his advantage to suggest that if you don't act now, you're not going to get this fantastic offer, which has since migrated to television, that same sense of creating this false scarcity.
False scarcity, though, is not as believable on TV. To reinforce the idea, then, an infomercial might use a counter to tick down the time. Sometimes there's a counter running up, tallying the number of items sold. This communicates what psychologists call social proof. If lots of other people are doing it, then you should too. And if you're not, what's wrong with you? Testimonials from people who are in a studio audience or may seem to be plucked randomly off the street serve a similar purpose.
I don't have to go to the store to buy a rotisserie chicken. I can make my own now and it comes out just scrumptious. I love it.
Social proof is often built right into the structure of an infomercial, where the pitchman works with a host who is ever so incredulous at first. Remy Stern.
She'll usually start off the infomercial with questions like, I can't really believe it does this, Jack.
You can make pasta with the Popeil automatic pasta maker in under 3 minutes.
From scratch?
No, no, no.
From scratch?
From scratch.
She's proxy for the people at home who are saying the same thing, which is, I can't believe it does that. Over the course of the infomercial, you'll watch that her tone changes and she'll finally sort of succumb to the pitch and realize that this is the greatest machine she has ever seen.
It really is an exciting pasta maker, isn't it? I mean, the Popeil automatic pasta maker is sensational. Now, there's the 1-800 number on your screen. I don't know what you're waiting for. It can't get any better than this.
Near the end of an infomercial, a pitchman will make one last effort to hook you by upping what's called the perceived value of the deal.
In addition to that, you get a package of semolina flour. You also get a pasta fork. You get a measuring cup. You get $100 worth of coupons, as well as a recipe booklet with English and Spanish instructions.
When and how to ask for the money, false scarcity, social proof, perceived value.
Everybody that calls in the next 30 minutes will also receive absolutely free my new sausage making attachment with spices and casings included.
Ron Popeil has turned the art of the infomercial into a science. And if Ron Popeil has brought the half hour form to its apotheosis, a company called Telebrands has done the same for the short form, spots that are no longer than a minute or two in length. Telebrands is headquartered in Fairfield, New Jersey. Displayed in the lobby of the building are honest-to-goodness trophies for products like the Better Pasta Pot and the World's Safest Can Opener. There's even a letter from a professor of mechanical design at Princeton University thanking Telebrands founder A.J. Kubani for a lecture he gave titled finding winning products. That's what they do at Telebrands.
A lot of people see these commercials on TV and they say something like, well, you know, if that blanket with sleeves can sell, then anything will sell on TV.
Telebrands president and CEO, AJ Kubani.
Well, it's really not that simple. It's actually quite challenging to come up with a winning TV product. Even for us, we've been in the business for 26 years and we still fail 90% of the time.
One of the first products Kubani advertised on TV was a pair of sunglasses in 1987.
Introducing AmberVision, the most amazing breakthrough in vision technology since glasses were invented.
He figured out that he could build brand recognition by blanketing the airwaves with cheap, direct-to-consumer commercials, and then take the product into retail stores where he slapped an As Seen on TV logo on them, which he designed himself. It's a very lucrative formula, he told me, so that's what he's been doing ever since. But Kubani says he has a few key requirements for any idea before Telebrands will even consider developing it into a product.
They all solve a common problem.
Are there places in your home where you wish you had a light, but you don't?
The other thing is that they have to be innovative, or at least perceived as being innovative.
Oh no, that tired old style's been around for a while. But now there's Easy Combs, the easy new way to create dozens of dazzling new hairstyles instantly.
They have to be easy to manufacture en masse, which means that they're usually low-tech.
Fed up with spending hundreds of dollars on purses that just get soiled by dirty floors? Then you need Purse Hook.
Ramping up high-tech products can take a long time, and we don't have that kind of time.
That's because the life cycle for a product, from the time it hits the air to the time it leaves the stores, can be as short as a few months. But every now and then, Telebrands comes up with a big seller that may linger for a few years. These are the products that pay the salaries of the 40 or so employees and have made Kubani a wealthy man. Maybe you've heard of the Ped Egg. That's P-E-D-E-G-G, Kubani.
It's a product that removes calluses or dead skin from the bottoms of people's feet. It works the same way that a cheese grater does, except it's better blades. And it catches the shaved calluses, so it doesn't make a mess.
Last year, more than 20 million people bought the Ped Egg. When I think back to the boardwalk of Atlantic City, as much as I can remember even the voices of some of the pitchmen out there, I can't remember if we ever bought anything. Turns out we did.
I bought knives, I bought choppers, I bought a blender.
My mother, Belle of Wola.
They had the gadgets that made fancy vegetables, which I bought and could never do when I brought it home. They made it look so easy. You know, they sliced the tomato with one sweep. No, never happened.
My mother even has a few gadgets still tucked away in her closet. They're just waiting to transform her kitchen and change her life.
This is the Vidalia Chop Wizard that I was telling you about. It does not do an onion as good as they say it. It's faster and easier by hand. I have a quick chopper, which I don't think I ever used. It's good for chopping, but you're a pretty good chopper. Oh, another one. This is a mixer jug. As you can see, I never used this one either. Some of the things I never used, brought it home and said, why did I buy it? And some things I did use.
Why did you buy it?
He was a good pitch man.
Ron Popeil likes to tell a story about his cousin, who sold a number of gadgets on the Atlantic City boardwalk in the 1950s. This cousin of his was such a good pitch man that one customer stood there and bought every item he had, only to walk away with two big shopping bags and toss the whole lot of it into a trash can not far away. Maybe that story's true, maybe it isn't. But it was in the 1950s that television took notice of the lowly pitchman for his ability to sell and lifted him up off the boardwalks and the street corners. Television, you could say, saved the pitchman. If TV ad rates keep slipping and traditional advertising becomes a thing of the past, maybe it'll be the pitchman's turn to save TV. For On the Media, I'm Mike Wolo.
I need a Vegemite. I need a handy appliance that'll scramble an egg while it's still inside its shell. Help me, Mr. Popeil.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and E.J. Vogt. with more help from James Hoffer and Dan Mozzie, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katja Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Happy New Year, Brooke.
Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to all of y'all.
Mr.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.